This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. We're starting today by reviewing some of the news of this past week. First, the ongoing fight over the potential release of former Massachusetts House Speaker Sal DeMasi. DeMasi is now serving year five of his 8-year prison sentence for taking kickbacks on a state contract. But federal officials have requested that he be released early as he battles cancer. U.S. District Court Judge Mark Wolf is asking for more information about DeMasi's health and about whether he still benefits from his political connections in Massachusetts. DeMasi's wife, Deborah DeMasi, speaking with Channel 2 this week, talked about her fight for her husband's compassionate release.
This has been going on for so long, and it's a very surreal thing to go through, and very hard to believe that it is something that could be possible, so that's hard to sink in.
Joining us to talk about this and the rest of the week's news are Arlene Isaacson, co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Great to see you.
Hi, nice to see you.
Also, Richard Tessay, former Republican leader of the Massachusetts State Senate. Welcome back, Richard.
Happy to be here.
So, Arlene, let's start with you. What do you make of this request to release former Speaker DeMasi, a compassionate release because of his terminal illness?
Well, I think it's about time that it happened. I'm so glad that the prosecutor has finally moved forward on it. You know, Sal's been suffering from essentially a slow and painful death. He's got stage 4 cancer. He's been in horrific conditions, hours and hours and hours, days away from his family, so that he hasn't been able to see them. He's been getting grossly inadequate treatment. And it's time to show compassion for someone who, while he may have done wrong and he's paid a price for it, has also done a lot of right and helped hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people in his time as speaker. For the LGBT community, he's an absolute hero. He's responsible for us winning, hugely responsible for us winning the right to marry, gay and lesbian civil rights bill, protecting our right to be foster and adoptive parents, AIDS-related issues. He was the architect of a health care for all, how ironic, when he was the speaker. And he was responsible for extraordinarily important environmental laws during his time there. So he's served 5 years. He's done his time. It's time to show compassion for someone who spent most of his life serving the public quite well.
He may have done very, very many things while in office that many people support, but there may be folks who say, you know, there are corruption charges here and he needs to serve his time. Go ahead.
He also used his position to enrich himself, and was involved in corruption and graft. And I think it was really important at the time for him to be sentenced. Obviously, Judge Wolf wanted to set an example for all the elected officials in Massachusetts that we're not going to put up with that. And at the time, certainly the sentence was adequate, I think, to the crime. And they caught him on that. Who knows what else was going on that they didn't catch him on. Having said all of that, though, I do believe that, at this point, the recommendations coming from the United States Federal Bureau of Prisoners, mm-hmm. Prisons, so they're the ones who are initiating it and saying that he could be, at this point, what good is keeping him in jail? It doesn't really...
So you think he served enough time?
I think he served enough time, and I think that you do have to be compassionate at this point. And if it were me, and I understand where the judge is, coming from, you need checks and balances on this, and somebody should be looking at it carefully. But if I were Judge Wolf, I would let him come back. I would let him out.
You know, I actually think that the judge in this case is suffering from the culture of arrogance in the judiciary, where I believe he punished Sal significantly more than he would have. He sentenced him to a significantly longer term than he would have had Sal not been the Speaker of the House. And so it's time to raise to a higher level. And instead of showing negative treatment to Sal, show him equal treatment.
I want to play another piece of tape here from DeMasi's wife, Deborah DeMasi, also from Channel 2. Here was what she told Channel 2 describing her husband's health.
What happened probably 6 weeks ago, 7 weeks ago, is they finally took him out for a swallowing function test, which he's been asking for 4 years. And they realized that everything that he had been saying was in fact true, that he can't swallow, that he aspirates food into his lungs, therefore he's had pneumonia a number of times, and that he needed to be on a pureed diet.
No, it certainly sounds horrific. I think that was the word you used to describe his health before. But the judge should require proof, right? Because right now you're really going on what his relatives are saying verbally.
Well, actually, not, because the Bureau of Prison had to agree to this, A, and B, Carmen Ortiz's office had to agree to it. So you have the two people who wanted him in prison originally saying, you know, we have to admit, the guy's dying.
And the Bureau, I think, does have to file some type of paperwork showing that there are extraordinary circumstances why they would, you know, call for that type of...
Right, but the judge raised the question about whether DeMacy might be still benefiting from his political connections here, and that this all comes as the judge is also reviewing the case of DeMacy's co-defendant, Richard McDonough, who apparently was allowed to get out early because he claimed that he had a substance use problem that he hadn't told officials about before he was sent to jail. So does that give the judge any more grounds here, do you think, Arlene, to question DeMacy's health?
It's understandable why he would wonder about that, given what may be going on with McDonough. But you just can't fake stage 4 cancer. Mm-hmm. And you can't, you know, Sal was on a feeding tube. As Debbie said, he was on liquid, only being able to ingest liquid food. And then they ran out of it. And he said, well, what am I going to eat? And they said, well, we'll have some more in a couple of weeks. So it was actually cruel, some of the treatment he endured. And, you know, when Deval Patrick was the governor, he talked about the extreme costs for health care for inmates. At this point, there's no public interest to be served in keeping him, Sal, behind bars. He served 5 years, which was a long term for this crime. He's dying. He can't reoffend. And the cost to the public of paying for his treatment is excessive. Hmm.
There have been some questions, though, about compassionate release more broadly. Earlier this year, a bill went before the state Senate for compassionate release, and it died in the House. Why do you think there isn't more of an appetite to bring this throughout the state for Massachusetts inmates? Why isn't there more of an appetite on the part of lawmakers to do this?
Legislature, a lot of times, is a reactive rather than a proactive institution. And I think that, look, the fact that this case has garnered so much attention, I would not be surprised to see this move, that type of bill move in the next session, because I do think that there is a consensus. And, you know, you do have a prison system, both on the state level and the county level, that's overflowing. And clearly you have situations where, you know, the public interest, you know, is no longer there to keep somebody who's terminally ill in jail. And, you know, and I think this case will serve as a sort of a harbinger of what may end up coming.
And do you think lawmakers could look hypocritical if, on the one hand, they say our former speaker should be released, there should be compassionate release for him, but maybe not for all inmates? I mean, do they run the risk of sending that message unless they do something with this legislation?
I think you got to look, you got to be consistent. But I do think that one of the top action items for the next legislative session is going to be sentencing reform in general, not just this area, but there's a broader area. I know the Chief Justice was just talking about this the other day. Governor Baker has an interest in it, the Senate President and the Speaker. And to see this as part of an overall package, I think, is probably pretty likely.
I'm actually hoping that Sal might end up being one of the poster children for the need to pass a law for compassionate release.
Right. Okay. Well, let's shift gears and talk about Children's Hospital. Yesterday, the State Public Health Council gave the go-ahead for the hospital to build a new $1 billion clinical building. This has been 6 years in the making at Children's, and it's been a controversial plan because it will result in the demolition of Prouty Garden, which is a healing garden in the courtyard of Children's Hospital. It was bestowed to the hospital about 60 years ago. We heard from Paula Skelly. She lost her daughter to cancer at Children's Hospital, and she told Channel 5 yesterday about how she utilized Prouty Garden. Let's listen.
These children deserve to have that place of peace. Parents deserve to have a place to go and just cry when they know that their child is dying. You know, it's a place of peace that can't be replaced by a tiny rooftop garden.
And that, of course, is in the plans to replace Prouty Garden as a place for children, particularly very ill children, to go outside. But the hospital president and CEO of Children, Sandra Fenwick, says that the hospital is overflowing. She says they're at about 99% capacity, and they need those 71 extra beds. And this is what she told Channel 4 about Prouty Garden.
We have said over and over again that the Prouty Garden is a loss to all of us. But the needs of the children, the needs of the families, the needs of the staff is first and foremost.
Richard, to say you have personal experience with Prouty Garden.
I can tell you I had my sister who spent long bouts of time, sometimes many months, at Children's Hospital in the 70s. And my family and I and my sister and spent a lot of time in that garden. And it is almost sacred ground. For families, you know, there's nothing worse than having a child who's, you know, terminally ill or severely ill, you know, in a hospital setting. That's bad enough, but you have this one area, you know, a lot of people call it a healing garden that you can go to. One of the, you know, memories I have is just seeing a woman, a kid actually, on a gurney without any arms and legs and talking so optimistically about what their future was going to be, you know. And I remember saying, and I still think about it, you know, to this day, you know, they were in such bad shape, but they were so optimistic about the future. And so losing that at Children's Hospital is going to be, you know, I don't think that the institution is going to be the same. And I'm not talking about the quality of care, but it's just something that's really special within the hospital. And, you know, aside from that, you know, we spend so much time right now talking about cost containment and how are we going to, you know, keep the healthcare costs in the state under control. And everybody, a lot of people who have looked at this, you know, have pretty much said, you know, Children's Hospital is the most expensive hospital here in Massachusetts. The expansion is $1 billion for 71 beds, which sounds, you know, really expensive in and of itself. But the fact is, once they are expanded and once they are bigger, you know, the whole problem with healthcare is that rather than going to local hospitals, people are sending their you know, patients here to Boston, whether it's Mass General or one of the partners' hospitals, or in this case, Children, and it drives up the cost of healthcare across the board. And a lot of people stepped forward, and, you know, Aaron, you know, a couple of the healthcare commissions, a couple of the employer groups, and said, you know, this is going to drive up costs. Probably not a good idea. So, but they are going to go ahead with it, and it's just they'll probably be tied up in lawsuits for a while longer. But it seems like it's a done deal.
Is your sister okay?
She's still hanging in there. She just had her 55th birthday.
All right,
which is pretty good.
Very good. Very good. Arlene, I'm wondering what you think about all of this at Children's Hospital.
Well, there's a couple of things. On the one hand, I'm lucky enough to know some of the brilliant doctors who work there, and what a wonderful institution it is. But Richard raises an important point that as consolidation of pediatric beds goes to Boston, that means community hospitals end up shutting down their pediatric units. Why does that matter? Well, if your child is really seriously ill, you want them at Children's Hospital. I completely agree. But a lot of the things that kids need to be in a pediatric unit for can be easily handled at a local community hospital. But as they close down, that's forcing families to drive from Taunton, where they closed one, or Cooley Dickinson in the western part of the state, to a city far away, which is troubling for the family. But there's one other variable that I think is important, which is I think before the state approves expansions of any of these large hospitals, they ought to start requiring them to fully disclose their finances in ways they never have. For example, do they have money in offshore accounts like the Cayman Islands, which Children's Hospital does and many hospitals do? Now, maybe that's right and maybe it's okay, but the state has the right to know how much do you have in an offshore Cayman Island, or why don't you have that money in a Massachusetts bank where it would benefit the Massachusetts economy instead of the economy of the Caymans?
Okay, well, we're going to have to go to politics here before we run out of time, because if we don't talk about
this
politics,
is where we stop agreeing.
Okay.
As guests.
Well, good, I think. Okay, we've got, what, 18 days? 18 days until the election, and we will get to the presidential race in a moment, but let's just start quickly with the ballot questions here in Massachusetts. And we had a poll, a WBUR poll this week of Massachusetts voters, which found increasing opposition to question two. That's dealing with the charter school cap. 52% oppose question two, 41% support. Our poll also found increasing support for the legalization of recreational marijuana, 55% saying that they support question four. Here's Steve Cazella. He's president of the Mass Inc. polling group, which conducted the WBUR poll. He talked about question four. Let's listen.
We found that almost everybody would be okay with the idea of people using marijuana in their homes. 84% said no, that that would not bother them. When you ask, though, about using marijuana in public, there we find only a third say that that would be okay with them.
And the thing that to me is interesting about the ballot questions is the money coming in for some of these questions. So if we take question four first, what we just heard Steve Cazella talking about, we've got public television's Rick Steves coming here and campaigning, saying he's in support of question four. And then we have Las Vegas casino magnates coming in and giving money to opponents of question four. So why do these big names care, and why are they putting money into this particular question? Any thoughts on that, Richard or Arlene? You look like you want to say
something. This is sort of a battle that's going on all across the country, not just in Massachusetts. And I do think that the question is probably going to pass, and I think it would be almost a shame if it does, because the state, already approved medical marijuana, and that and that's still being permitted, and it's probably about 50%, not even 50% of, of being of set up right now, and then we're going to just leapfrog to complete legalization. I just think that there are a lot of things that people aren't thinking through right now. And you do have, obviously, the alcohol. I noticed, I read somewhere that the alcohol industry is pouring a lot of money into this question. On the no side, you do have people who think they're going to make a lot of money off of marijuana that have in Colorado and other states that look at Massachusetts as pretty fertile territory. So,
So it always happens.
It always happens.
And it's happening with the charter schools as well. What we know about question two, which would raise the cap on charter schools, they're calling this the most expensively fought TV advertising battle of any referendum in any state this election cycle. So about $18.5 million, I think, spent so far, according to the Center for Public Integrity. And so we've got on the yes side a New York-based nonprofit, Families for Excellent Schools, and they have donated about 70% of the funding in support of question two as of the last report. On the no side, primarily teachers' unions, including the Massachusetts Teachers Association and the National Education Association. So what about the money in this particular question? What do you make of this, Arlene?
Well, a lot of those who oppose the question don't have money. The PTAs in the state oppose it, the school committees, but they have no money to put into the campaign. All they have is their name, PTAs and school committees. So that explains why that money is coming in from teachers' associations. On the other side, you're right, there's so much money coming in specifically from Wall Street, New York specifically, so much so that a friend of mine sent me a post recently. They said that the theme song for question two will be that Sinatra line, it's up to New York, New York.
She's singing now.
I gotta just disagree with this a little.
Okay, I was waiting.
From the minute, and I was in the legislature when charter schools passed and were initiated here in the state. They have been opposed by the teachers' unions from day one. And for the last 20 or 30 years, this has, been a number one priority to try to hold back as much as possible. And there are a lot of Democrats, which is the most interesting thing, that do support this, that understand that there are certain urban underperforming school districts across the state that traditional fixes aren't going to work, and you have to give those parents.
But let's talk about not the question, but the money.
So the teachers' union in the state is the most powerful union. They take their money directly from employees' paychecks, and that's where you see that coming. On the other end, I do think you see a lot of people who they don't have an agenda, except that they understand how important education is in Massachusetts, and a lot of them are Democrats who have formed organizations, raised money, and are trying to give kids as many choices as they can.
Well,
I
was talking
Bill Gates, for instance, and other people like that.
I a couple of months ago, I was having a drink with a legislator who is very familiar with the ways and means. He's done a lot of financial work in the State House in terms of how the budget works out. And he spent the entire night talking about his fear of this question. And I said, you know, I agree with you. And he said, no, you don't get it, Arlene. You don't understand how much money is going to come from the public schools if this question passes. I tried to change the topic. He wouldn't even let me do it because he was so worried about what would happen with state finances.
And that's a scare tactic. And I got
to
tell you,
this is a private conversation.
No, I'm just saying,
one else was around.
No, but that's the advertising. And I would say that when you look at it, the problem that the proponents have had is they got into this fight about, bean counting, as opposed to...
But it's a lot of money.
No, but those kids, any kid that leaves a community to go to a charter school, even though they're not in the school is still reimbursed.
But they're never fully reimbursed. They've never been fully reimbursed. That's absolutely not true.
And we can have this debate for the next half hour. As long as you're doing that, you're missing the big picture. And I think the big picture is a civil rights issue. Poor people in this state, particularly, immigrants and the people who need choices the most don't have them, and parents should have the best opportunities for their kids.
And the problem, the real civil rights issue, is that when that money comes out of the public schools, the remaining kids, Black, Hispanic, poor, Latino, immigrants, they're stuck with fewer teachers, fewer resources, fewer classes because the money got drained out to the children.
Okay, we have to.
It hurts
the kids.
Yeah.
I think we maybe need to.
We're very passionate about
it. I think I want to move on to national politics. Let's see what we can do here. Okay.
But people watching have stayed on this question, and that's why the money is coming in on the other side.
You had to get the last word there, Richard. Anyway, national politics, the headline, obviously, out of the third and final presidential debate this week was that Donald Trump is not saying if he's going to accept the election results. Now, you can argue about whether that should be the headline, but it was the headline, and many people still talking about it. Governor Charlie Baker's office released a statement yesterday condemning Trump. I just want to read you a little bit about what he says. Quote, the strength, and this is from Baker, quote, the strength of our nation's democratic system is based in part on the consent of all participants to honor the outcomes. The governor believes that Mr. Trump's failure to concede this foundational principle of our nation's democratic system is irresponsible and another example of why he lacks the temperament to be president. And Baker was also asked, is he going to vote for one of the candidates? Because so far he said he's not voting for either. And again, he reaffirmed he will not be voting for either major party candidate this election. So what do we make of the governor sitting on the sidelines here? Arlene, you first.
Well, when he regarding first his critique of Trump's comments about not necessarily accepting the results of the elections, on that one, when it comes to the governor's reaction, I second that emotion. I think he's right to criticize Trump's on that one. It just goes to the core principles of the way our democracy works, is that, like it or not, you accept the results of elections. I'm disappointed that the governor is saying he won't vote in the election at all, because, as we all know, no matter what, one of those folks is going to win. And for full disclosure, I support Hillary. And it is pretty frightening to think that Trump could possibly win, although thankfully I think she's in the lead right now.
Okay. Are you guys going to start yelling again?
No, I think he made a very tactical mistake, because I think he had a good debate up until that point, and obviously the headlines ended up being about that. And I kind of think, in probably his mind, I would have obviously said I'm going to accept the results, but I think by him saying that, it would have felt like he was conceding the race. So he didn't necessarily say he wasn't going to accept the results. He said,
I'll keep you in suspense.
He said, I'll let you know at the time. And of course, the press.
No, he said he'd accept the results if he won.
That was the next day. But the press, hyperventilates every time. It's clearly, press is clearly in Hillary's corner, and they're going to amplify anything.
Fox News is not in Hillary's corner.
I'm telling you, it wasn't the right thing to say. But
are you a Trump supporter?
He wasn't my first choice or the second choice, but I believe in the rule of law, and I think that, going back to what we were saying before, is Hillary getting special treatment under? I used to think everything was on the level. Watching this whole thing, Bill Clinton on the plane with the Attorney General. The FBI, obviously doing a real hack job
and
on
Putin
the investigation.
Helping Trump.
I do think, I can't vote for her, and I will vote for Trump if I have to.
Then, what do you think of Baker?
I'd go with the Libertarian, but the Libertarians.
You wouldn't go for Gary Johnson.
If it was Johnson, I would have an easier time with that. You know, I think Charlie's doing the right thing because he doesn't want to be a national figure. He went and ran for office to help Massachusetts. And from the very beginning, I think people are so sick of our governors. You know, the minute they get in, they're playing national politics, they're running for president. Mm-hmm. Had he got involved and not at the very beginning come out and said, I'm not voting for Trump, I'm not, you know, the press every single time they saw him, and they still have done it the whole way through.
Go ahead, keep
you know,
it going.
Trump just said something. You know, what do you think of, you know, and Charlie's had to react to it, and it takes the focus off of what he's doing here, and I think people want him to be a good governor
okay.
here.
Well,
we like you. I'm saying.
Oh, okay. That's because we're sitting in the same room right now. We have just enough time left for our hubbubs, right? And we're going to have to do these rather quickly. These are the brief stories that, you know, maybe didn't make the headline, but they caught our attention this week. Arlene.
I found an article on October 18th by Christian Wade, who is a Statehouse reporter for a lot of North Shore papers like Gloucester and Salem. He talked about the study to look at repealing archaic laws in Massachusetts, laws that criminalize vagrancy, fornication, sodomy, blasphemy, and one of my favorites, resorting to taverns for immoral solicitation. Now, I'm familiar with these because years ago I worked on a bill to repeal the anti-gay sodomy laws, which parenthetically never used the word sodomy. Instead, it says, whoever commits the abominable and detestable crime against nature with mankind shall be punished by up to 20 years. So there's a couple of other funny ones. I'll just do one last one, which is attention, sports fans. There are penalties for profane or impure language at a sporting event. That's my fave. So some of these are clearly have been deemed unconstitutional or will be, but we really ought to get them cleaned off the books and stay tuned, sports fans.
Okay, Richard, your hubbub.
My hubbub is I'm going to spend the weekend just doing errands. One of the errands I got to do is buy some Halloween candy for next weekend.
Mm-hmm.
So not knowing what to buy, I do have a lot of kids come by my house. I came across
you did some research.
Article from Peapod. They just put out a study, and they looked at all the 43 different types of candies, what sells the most in Massachusetts.
Should we guess?
Here are the top five.
Okay.
You want to guess? Or?
I want to guess. Snickers.
Nope, not on the list.
Not
Tootsie
even.
Rolls.
Nope. Number one, Hershey's Kit Kat candy bars, snack size. Number two, Milky Way bars, fun size. Number three, candy corn.
Candy corn?
Number four, yuck. Reese's peanut butter cups. Number five, Nestle's Butterfinger bars, fun size. That's what people are buying, and so if you have kids, they're going to come back with a lot of that stuff.
Okay, good to know. Good to know about the most popular Halloween candy. Mine is a Kickstarter campaign by none other than the Smithsonian. Hmm. Did you know that the Smithsonian is doing a Kickstarter campaign? Do you know what for?
What for?
To restore Dorothy's ruby slippers. They're trying to raise $300,000 to preserve the famous slippers in The Wizard of Oz. And as of this morning, they've raised $239,000 so far. So
go, Dorothy.
There we go. Okay. Thanks very much to both of you. Whoa, for being with us. Arlene Isaacson, co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Thank you.
Thank you.
Richard Tessay, former Republican leader of the Massachusetts Senate. Thanks to you as well. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.